The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking level, adjusting camera, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
All right, welcome to a Wednesday. As the chat room is telling me, it's hump day. You know, I'm not even going to go there. It's such an old radio thing. You know, after today, you're over the hump of the work week. It means there's still two more days you got to wake up and do this before you get to relax. Yeah. Anyway, you know, I don't know about you, but I watched these hearings and the January 6th hearings. And with each successive one, it's apparent that the committee is making the case, drawing the direct line from Donald Trump to the Oath Keepers, to the Proud Boys, to the attack on the Capitol, to the thing to hang Mike Pence from outside the Capitol building. I mean, it's so blazingly clear. And yet we have people who are like lemmings. They just follow this man. And think about who they're following. He's a fraud in every sense of the word, a complete and total fraud. I don't think he's ever worked an honest day in his life. You know, when I was a kid living in New York, people knew who he was because he was like a sideshow. When I went back to New York, my family moved to Florida when I was like 11. I you know what? For the first part, I don't remember. I don't know if he was a fixture or not. But when I moved back to New York after college, and Donald Trump was then, you know, the playboy, the rich playboy. And he'd always be out on the town with a woman on his arm. You know, he was a womanizer, even though he was married to Ivana. What, how weird is that? His wife was Ivana, and they named their daughter Ivanka. It just everything about him and his family has always made my skin crawl. You know, after you hear about Donald Trump, or God forbid, run into him, you feel like you need a shower. And then he meets Mark Burnett. And Mark Burnett is the man who produced The Apprentice. And when Donald Trump started on The Apprentice, he was a failed businessman. Everything, he filed bankruptcy numerous times. He was in debt. He was not a billionaire. That was the role that he played for this character on this so-called reality show, The Apprentice. And so many people in this country buy it. And what's even more disgusting, they follow him thinking that he's some kind of genius. The only thing he's genius at is lying, is making shit up, and thinking that his shit doesn't stink. Because the last thing that we learned about in the hearing yesterday was when Liz Cheney told us that it was Trump himself who picked up the phone and called one of the witnesses who we have not seen yet or may not see at all in the testimony, but somebody who was set to talk to the committee. And he personally called this person, and we know why, right? Because this is how he always operates. And he did this after the previous hearing in which they said this is a problem, that there are people in Trump's orbit who are reaching out to our witnesses and potential witnesses and basically warning them not to testify. Well, that's, you know, that's witness tampering. And yet these people, and I hesitate to call them people because they are less than human, still carry his water, still defend him. You see them swarming on Twitter. I felt horrible yesterday that I mentioned Aaron Rupar, who now writes his own Substack thing. He's working for himself these days. But he has a great Twitter feed, and they all, because he was live tweeting the hearing yesterday, they all swarmed him. Well, I've been swarmed by the trolls on Twitter, and it's not fun. But, you know, these people still defend this idiot. Now, if you look at the polling, a lot of the news articles today are saying, well, he's not a slam dunk for, you know, to win the next election anymore. He's not a slam dunk to win the Republican nomination. It appears as if some people are at least listening to the facts and you know, taking it in, taking them in, and understanding that maybe some of the shine is coming off the Teflon Don. And that's good, except when you think who's waiting in the wings. Because, hey, rest of the country, I'm talking to you from Florida. There's this guy, Ron DeSantis, who's even worse. He's worse on so many levels. You know, and it makes me wonder why things are the way they are here. You know, this experiment in democracy that we have that's 250 some odd years old, you know, needs a lot of fixing. The Constitution needs a lot of tweaking. It needs updating. But we have this now Supreme Court that's ruled, in every sense of the word, by these crazy fundamentalists. And I call them that because they are. You know, there's, let me tell you about our guest coming up at the bottom of the hour. As somebody who was on the show last year when he released a book, the book was called Laboratories of Autocracy, A Wake-Up Call from Behind the Lines. And the author is a guy named David Pepper, who's a lawyer, a political activist, and former chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party from 2015 to 2021. He just stepped down. And he's a prolific author. Most of his books are novels, but he wrote this one nonfiction book, which is kind of depressing but important, Laboratories of Autocracy. And what he's saying is, here's an exact quote, okay? It's anonymous, often corrupt politicians in state houses across the country who pose the greatest dangers to American democracy. Because these state houses no longer operate as functioning democracies, these unknown politicians have all the incentive to keep doing greater damage and cannot be held accountable, however extreme they get. This has driven steep declines in states like Ohio and others across the country, and collectively it's placed American democracy in its greatest peril since the dawn of the Jim Crow era. So, and then the little description says Pepper doesn't stop there. He lays out a robust pro-democracy agenda outlining how everyone from elected officials to business leaders to everyday citizens can fight back. And that's one of the reasons I wanted him on here today, because we need some guidance. And you know what? We're not getting it from the Democratic Party proper, because the party is FUBAR. Now, when I criticize the Democratic Party, I'm not saying anything about the Republicans. And I want you to get that. They're mutually exclusive. I can talk about one without talking about the other. If you want to talk about the Republicans, be ready for a whole litany of expletives. Because they're really sick. The Republican, today's Republican Party is diseased. And the only way to put it out of its misery is to put it out of its misery. That party has to be demolished and started over again from scratch. What that party has become is frightening. I saw an interview with a guy named Tim Miller the other night. I should try to get him on the show. He's got a new book out. He's a never Trumper. Brian Williams used to have him on his show all the time before he left MSNBC, because I think Brian Williams was a never Trumper Republican too. But hey, that's just me. I have nothing to back that up. It's just a feeling I get. Anyway, Tim Miller, you know, he worked for Jeb Bush. He is a Republican, but he cannot stand what has happened to his party. And because of that, he makes some sense, right? And he wants them out of there at any and all costs. In fact, I got to share, this is long, but hey, we have time because David Pepper is coming on at the bottom of the hour. So I still have about 21 minutes. And that's good. You see, this week I found two lengthy threads on the Twitter machine. One was from David Pepper that we'll share some of that when he gets here. And that's what prompted me to call him and say, hey, you were on the show last year, but I read this thread and it's about how we can fix things. It's about a clause, a very underappreciated clause, I guess, or very a lesser known clause in the Constitution that's called the Guarantee Clause. I didn't know about the Guarantee Clause, but we'll wait for David Pepper to go over that. But I do want to share with you this thread that was on Twitter just a couple of days ago from a guy named, his name is Joe, but his Twitter handle is at Dempsey2, T-W-O, Dempsey2. And bear with me because, again, it's kind of lengthy, but it's important. So this guy, Joe, writes, on November 16th, and I will link to this, link this thread on my blog where I post today's show so you can read the whole thing. And I'm not going to read all the accompanying documents that he posts along with this thread just because there's so much there. But I will post it on my website, NicoleSandler.com/7-13-22. That's today's date. So you can go back later and read it for yourself, okay? And I'm also going to post the Bob Dylan song, Everything is Broken. That's the title of today's show. And if I could play music on this program without getting copyright violated, that's the song I would have started with today. Everything is Broken, Bob Dylan. Okay, now to this Twitter thread. Joe at Dempsey2 writes, on November 16th, 2020, an organization called USA Transform completed a 990 tax form. For our purposes, a 990 reports information to the IRS from tax-exempt political organizations. Accountants and tax lawyers can clean that up a bit if they'd like. So what is USA Transform? Compelled by the love of Christ, they seek to educate and encourage faith-oriented individuals and organizations to advocate for and advance positive outcomes in the social welfare and public policy arenas. For the love of Christ. Well, now that SCOTUS essentially ended the separation of church and state, it would be fair to say this, quote, political organization is pushing hard in the religious public policy arena. It's as if they're charitably advancing a Christian nationalist policy, a CNP, if you will. Remember those three letters, Christian Nationalist Policy, CNP. You may have heard about the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers 1776 Returns Plan. If you'll recall, there was a deadly insurrection at the Capitol on January 6, 2021. You may have read about it or seen it on the news. It's a pretty big fucking deal. In that 1776 Returns Plan, which he has posted here, so that's why you may want to go back and read the thread, we see that one of the objectives of those groups attacking the Capitol and putting the lives of our lawmakers, federal staffers, employees, etc., at risk was to, quote, occupy certain federal buildings with a minimum of 50 people. And he's got all the documentation there. On January 4th, 2020, the Capitol Police approved a permit for a group called Women for a Great America / 50 plus Days of Blessings. According to their permit, they were there to pray and worship for our nation. This was not the only permit issued to Christians. But what's different about this particular permit is that it was approved for multiple days. It allowed the group to be there from January 4th through the 10th. Obviously, that includes the 6th. Multiple days? How long were the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers planning to occupy? Joe continues. It's a nice thought, though, isn't it? 50 or so women camping out on the Capitol grounds for a few days in January praying for our nation. I suppose it would be, but that may not have been the full intent of Women for a Great America. You see, they didn't exactly market their presence at the Capitol as being a prayer, as being prayerful, so much as they called it a, quote, battle cry for the Republic. They were going to be praying, all right, but for war for God's purpose for our nation. That's a quote. War for God's purpose for our nation. Who prays for war? Anti-abortionists, that's who. I know, my head is spinning too. We're all over the place here. Stay with me, he writes. Again, I'm reading you this Twitter thread that blew my mind the other night from a guy named Joe at Dempsey2. All right, he continues. Women for a Great America is anti-abortion. They also seem to know a hell of a lot about the inner workings of the Supreme Court, like how the justices meet in a private conference the week after a hearing like, say, oh, I don't know, Dobbs, for instance. Expected? This anti-abortion prayer group had expectations from the Supreme Court regarding the case we now know they used to overturn Roe and take fundamental health rights away from women. Who told them about SCOTUS inner workings? Hold that thought. Way back on March 18th, 2014, the LA Times published an article about a group called United in Purpose. You may know this group already. If not, visit Visions or Vision Surreal at on Twitter at Vision Surreal for the education. Why am I bringing this up from 8 years ago? Well, did you see how they were partnering with Christian organizers and anti-abortion groups all the way back then? For what, I wonder? Because besides, of course, recruiting 100,000, quote, champions to identify and store in a database unregistered Christians and get them to vote. If you want to know more about United in Purpose, you're not alone. I wanted to see who was in charge. Remember, just two tweets ago, an article where you read the name Bill Dallas. We didn't read the article, but it was in the supplemental information that Joe posts here. So he posted this article, which included the name Bill Dallas. It's up there, two tweets up. Said, please see highlighted and underlined excerpts below. And there's a bunch. And I'm not going to read it for you because it'll all fall into place and you can go back and read it later. So he said, you're going to want to read this entire article from May 2020. Trust me, I told you this one was going to be intensive. Remember that LA Times article about United in Purpose? Recall the effort to store unregistered Christians in a database? Well, just for giggles, I looked at some additional 990 tax exemption forms for that USA Transform, like the one I mentioned in tweet three of this thread. I noticed a familiar name. In 2018, the name is William Dallas. Bill Dallas, if you like. UIP equals USA Transform. It's the same people. That article just above, that We Whisper tweet, had enough information to choke a Trojan horse, he writes. Take a moment to rest your eyes. We have a lot to process. We're getting close like a family. Speaking of Trojan horses, I can't forget Trump's promise. And then he quotes something Trump there. He says, Trump promised a Christian group that he would appoint judges aligned with religious right practices. Judges like Brett Kavanaugh, for example. Do you know who was instrumental in Kavanaugh's appointment? You do, because you've heard this on this show. A guy named Leonard Leo. And then he posts a great article on Leo. Below is the part that truly stood out to me. The highlighted remarks are from a Council for National Policy board member. The name might be familiar. It's Rebecca Hagelin. You may remember her from tweets, from such tweets as the third one in this thread where she was the treasurer of USA Transform on that 990 tax exemption form from 2020. Or you may remember her from becoming the president of United in Purpose in 2021. Yup, breathe, he says, there's more. Remember how there was a lot of anti-abortion throughout this thread? Well, Rebecca Hagelin was also part of something called the Human Coalition. It's an anti-abortion outfit whose main page opens with her with her bio, right? And then he says, did you see the part where she wrote a weekly column for the Washington Times? Remember the Moonies cult? They were the ones who mass married a bunch of strangers back in the day. Well, the Washington Times was founded by the leader of the Moonies. Remember Reverend Sung Young Moon? Yeah. Fun fact, the son of the leader of the Moonies cult, Sean Moon, has his own church called Rod of Iron Ministries. You may have seen it. They worship AR-15s. Oh, and he was also present at the Capitol on January 6th. Come back and read this. And then he says, okay, that's the end of part one in case the thread breaks. But there's lots more. Part two, he says, so let's recap. Hagelin, Rebecca, the former VP of the Heritage Foundation, a CNP, there's that acronym again, a CNP board member, praised the guy who chooses the Supreme Court judges, is an avid anti-abortionist who writes columns for a cult leader's paper whose founder's son worships AR-15s. She was the president of United in Purpose. Did I leave anything out? Oh, right. The treasurer of USA Transform, which is also United in Purpose. Jesus, Rebecca is busy. Joe continues. Being a board member of the Council for National Policy seems like an important position. I mean, you're really close to Leonard Leo and the Supreme Court of the United States. So close, in fact, you can't get much closer to the Supreme Court unless you're a justice or married to one. That's right, kids. Jenny Thomas, who was texting Mark Meadows about an insurrection, routinely gave speeches at the Council for National Policy. And she also presents the United in Purpose Impact Awards to the likes of Mark Meadows. Is your head starting to spin yet? All right, back to it. We're not quite done yet, he writes. Remember the Women for a Great America 50-plus Days of Blessings prayer group that had the multi-day permit for the Capitol over January 6th? Well, they were endorsed by a guy named Lou Engle. Were these Christian groups used for donations and as a Trojan horse on the 6th? Engle is an intercessor, and you need to know what that is. For that, head on over to @gal_suburban for the education. Gal_suburban writes, a curious photo to use Joe Biggs, a leader of the Proud Boys and charged with conspiracy related to the violent attempted coup on January 6th, to accuse CA, I don't know what CA is, of colluding with big tech on elections. All right, I'm kind of lost here. All right, so where's the rest of this thread? Now I lost the rest of the thread. This is what I get for reading it straight from the Twitter. All right. Show replies. All right. So, oh, okay. Then he says, we're not quite done yet. Oh, no, I read that already. Lou Engle. Okay. Okay. All of this merely shows that for years, the Council for National Policy, its board members, Leonard Leo, Rebecca Hagelin, its speakers like Jenny Thomas, have worked for the Supreme Court to end women's rights and impose Christian will. What's next? Well, if we do not wish to live in a white Christian nation, we had better defeat the Republicans in November, because there is no GOP. There is now the CNP. And you can think of that as either the Center for National Policy or Christian Nation Policy, because there is no difference. Joe says this has begun to take hold in some states, perhaps even yours. Confirm you're registered and vote in November. And this is the part that got to me. I read through that whole thing and then I get to this line. And he says, confirm you're registered and vote in November. It may be your last chance to have your vote count in an America not yet stolen by Christians who prefer fascism to democracy. And then he said, and finally, I know, not all Christians and not all Republicans. To you, I ask that you show up to vote. Don't sit this one out. This is the election to save a democracy. Here's the part. He writes, it's going to feel weird voting for a Democrat, But I assure you, the alternative is unthinkably worse. He's a Republican. This guy is a Republican who realized everything that's going on and is telling his fellow Republicans, look, it may feel weird to vote for a Democrat. You have no other choice. He says the alternative is unthinkably worse. And then he says, thank you to anyone who has read this far. You have my appreciation and gratitude for allowing me to intrude upon your time. I hope the information is useful to you. Please feel free to share it so that we have the largest possible amount of informed voters. And then he added a couple of things. He said he's got some pinned tweets. And he said the first pinned tweet was about not occupying federal buildings unless there were 50 people. Every permit issued for January 6th was for 50 Christians to pray. Each positioned in front of one of the buildings identified to occupy in the 1776 returns plan. He says, tell reporters. The second one, sorry, got a choke. Second one was about the Great Awakening Project. He says, mind the gap. Hold on, I need water. And then he posts an epilogue. He says, I'm not the first to make the UIP USA Transform connections. Much work has already been done by those tagged above, as well as at Vickery Sec, at Lynette 3006-7504. That sounds like a bot. At Kath Stewart and many others. I thank them all for their amazing work and apologize for any inadvertent oversights. And then he adds another article that he inadvertently failed to provide. But that's the thread. And I think it's pretty epic and pretty important. And it's a perfect leap into our guest. Now, I'm not going to read to you the entire thread that our guest, David Pepper, wrote, because I'll have him explain it to us. Ah, and it looks like he is there. So what perfect timing. So let me admit him into the Zoom room and get him up on our screen, and then I can bring David Pepper in, and we can have this conversation with him, because it's all too important. But I'll tell you what I want to do before I bring him on, is play this video. So, David, I hope you are cool with this. When he wrote the book, Labs of Autocracy, he gave a little bit of an explainer on Twitter about sort of like what's at stake here. So I want to show you that, and then we'll bring David on if I can get this thing working. Here we go. All right. So this is David Pepper, a video from his Twitter regarding the labs of autocracy.
Katie Porter style whiteboard to walk through how quickly you can lose your democracy if you don't fight for it. Uh-huh. We've seen this happen in other countries, but it's also happened in our own not that long ago. So it's lost in history. But shortly after the Civil War, you had very active black participation in Southern elections. In Louisiana, for example, almost 128,000 registered black voters actually outnumber the number of registered white voters in that state. In Alabama, South Carolina, Mississippi, other southern states, very high levels of black registered voters and participation. You had a 61% black voter turnout in presidential elections then. But that also meant you had black elected officials at all levels. We're talking mayors and sheriffs. We're talking dozens of state reps in the different state houses, sometimes the majority, sometimes speakers of the House. You had black statewide officials such as secretaries of state, Supreme Court justices, lieutenant governors, for example. You even had between 1869 and 1901 at least one black member of Congress every single year from the South. So things must have felt like democracy was moving forward, right? All this would be gone in a matter of years. By 1910 in Louisiana, the number of black registered voters had plummeted to 700. Wow. In these other states, about 3,000 black registered voters remained. How did that happen? You had a relentless effort to say that all this participation was leading to voter fraud. Sound familiar? And corruption. And so you had brutal voter suppression to wipe out this participation. You had courts who, despite the 14th and 15th Amendment, did not step up and protect voting rights of black voters. And you also had, ultimately, the federal government also fail to protect those voting rights. And you also had brutal violence from the KKK,
nice.
Which basically together cratered democracy.
Mm-hmm.
You had only 2% turnout in future presidential elections, and all those black elected officials I mentioned, gone. Without their participation and representation, what followed? Almost a century of Jim Crow from those state houses. Folks, the lesson is clear. If you don't fight to protect your democracy, you can lose it almost overnight.
If you don't fight to protect your democracy, you can lose it almost overnight. That's David Pepper, and David Pepper joins us now. David, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us again. David Pepper is a lawyer, a political activist, a former chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party, and a prolific author of a few books, mostly political thrillers, but this one truly, I think, kind of depressing nonfiction book, Laboratories of Autocracy, a wake-up call from behind the lines. And David, everything you wrote about is happening now. These people in the state houses who we may not know of are making massive changes to our political system, and they're doing it, you know, with the help of the Supreme Court. Thank you for joining us today. And the reason I invited you on now is because of this thread that you put on Twitter just last week about something in the Constitution that could help us here, right? So
yeah.
So tell us about this, how you came to this this thread here.
Yeah, it's good to be back with you, and thank you. I put my book out last October, and the second part of the title is a wake-up call from behind the lines. It was me trying to say, folks, don't get distracted by Marjorie Taylor Greene, as bad as she is. It's the hundreds of people just like her in state houses who are actually in majorities doing great, great damage to our democracy and the fundamental rights. And it gets worse and worse and worse by the year. And I hate to say it, with what's happened in the last couple of months, more people are seeing that. But here's who saw this. This is what the thread was about. The framers saw it. The clause that I talk about that I did this thread on, and it's something that it may feel like arcane constitutional law, but I actually think it should drive how we all think about what we need to do. It's called the guarantee clause. It's in the Constitution, totally overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
But it literally is the sentence, and it comes right before a sentence that the United States shall protect all states from foreign invasion. Foreign invasion. So that's pretty important.
Yep.
But before they got to foreign invasion, they said the following: the United States shall guarantee to all states of the Union a republican form of government.
A republican form of government, yeah. But it's not what we might think on the surface
it
that means.
It's not what the right wing now says. The founders saw their revolution they thought they were leading was going from a monarchy to a republican form of government. And by republican form of government, the key concept was that the people were sovereign, that governments were supposed to represent the people. And the thing they were changing was governed by the monarchy or elite interests as opposed to the people themselves. The guarantee clause, they were very concerned that as they built the national republic, what we would today call democratic governance is what they meant by republican form of government.
Right.
They greatly worried that, and this is why I wrote the book Laboratories of Autocracy. They greatly worried, as we should worry now, that state houses and states have so much power over our democracy, so many of the rules of elections, so much of the substance that we all care about, the rules that we live by every day, are determined not by Washington, but by state houses.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they wrote that guarantee clause was a warning to all of us that if these state houses ever fall into the wrong hands, they were worried about the monarchy using state houses as a backdoor to undermine a new country, for example. Or they even worried, and this is what, if you've heard of ALEC, this is sort of what they were thinking about.
The American Legislative Exchange Council. We know ALEC well.
This right-wing operation that's taken over state houses. They worried that either the monarchy or what they called elite interests and, quote, rich men would, through state houses, basically lock in powers from state houses to undermine the whole democracy. That was their worry. And the reason they wrote the guarantee clause was they worried about it so much, they basically said, this cannot happen. And if it happens, just like a foreign invasion, the United States must fight to make sure every state is basically a Republican form of government, that the people are sovereign. And so when I look at, I'm sorry, I have a door that's squeaking. Give me one second.
No worries. No worries. So that, David Pepper is with us. Oh, that was quick. Okay.
When I look at what's happening today, where you have private interests, the Koch brothers, ALEC, extremists through gerrymandering, so that in these state houses, you can't even touch these places. The people are essentially unmoored. These places are unmoored from the people, you know, all around this country. You know, Ohio, where I'm from, supports Roe v. Wade. Polls show that. Texas, Florida. But the people in office are doing the exact opposite of what the people in these states think.
Right.
Because of the gerrymandered state houses. The founders would say, this is what we were warning you about. This is what can happen if you allow your state level governments to no longer be basically representative of the people. And that's why, and once it happens, it's very hard to claw it back. Mm-hmm. So the guarantee clause is several things. One, it's an oath that Joe Manchin took when he took an oath to the Constitution. The Senate, the House, the president are supposed to be fighting very hard to protect a Republican form of government in all 50 states. The same way Ulysses Grant back in the late 1800s, when the KKK and others started threatening voting rights in the newly Democratic South, when blacks could register to vote, they took that very seriously for a while because they wanted to make sure these were democratically, you know, informed and elected institutions. So it's really a requirement on these office holders. But I also think it's something that we all should think about, and this is more on the political side. We have for too long, because we have this federal swing state mindset. Oh, if elections are about winning a few swing states so we can win some federal offices, we have for too long simply allowed dozens of states to fall into a state where they're no longer, I think, democratically governed.
They just, right, no.
You can't no. look at many of these states when almost every election is guaranteed, when extremists are in offices that in a normal democracy, they would never win.
Right.
Because let's face it, most of the laws they are passing, and this is why they rig elections through gerrymandering, are deeply unpopular. So when you start to look at these different states, I mean, I don't look at Ohio State House and think it doesn't represent Ohio. Ohio, again, not we support Roe v. Wade. For goodness sakes, we would never support the kind of laws they're pushing forward without even exceptions. I mean, it's insane.
Right.
They don't. And that's true of all these states. We are essentially, we have allowed through sort of near-term political thinking about federal swing states to accept this terrible reality that dozens of our states are no longer meeting what I would describe as the Republican form of government guarantee.
Right. And again, keep saying Republican form of government. That's the old Ben Franklin. What is it? A republic if you can keep it.
Exactly.
We have not kept it.
In many of these states. And we have almost just sort of, well, that's just life. It can't be. And so my point is, if you are in a federal office holder, you have an obligation to make sure, just as everyone should have a right to vote, every single person in this country should live in a state that meets the guarantee clause.
Uh-huh.
But secondly, if you are politically involved and you're not an office holder, even though you haven't taken the oath of the Constitution, we need to change our entire mindset about politics. That it can no longer only be about the fact that we hope John Fetterman wins in Pennsylvania and Tim Ryan wins in Ohio. It's got to be every state house needs to be. Again, there are Republican states. There will be Republican state houses, but they shouldn't be rigged so the people have no choice.
Right.
These districts shouldn't be drawn and voters shouldn't be suppressed so that the outcomes of almost every state house in this country are guaranteed 99%. We have to break that up. And until we do, I think this explosion of extremism is going to continue. And one thing that really is an example of this, because we think about politics through this federal swing state mindset, in state after state, not just far right states, but moderate states, Arizona, Georgia, both blue last time, Ohio, many others, we let dozens of districts go totally uncontested.
Yeah.
And if you want extremism to explode, it will explode when someone passes and votes for the most extreme things you've ever thought of, totally toxic, and then the next election, they don't even have a challenger.
Right.
Think about what we are doing to that person. They'll think, my God, I can get away with anything. And so we have to stop basically not focusing on all these places that have a lot of power, but also when there's only one person speaking in them, have become hotbeds of extremism in a matter of a decade. And that's sort of the story I tell in my book about how that's happened in Ohio. The truth is it's happening in Missouri, in Tennessee, and all over Florida.
Florida. I'm in Florida. And, yeah.
And it's because we've let it happen by basically not in the same way that not enough Republicans challenged Trump when he was acting nuts.
Mm-hmm.
We are doing the same thing at the state level by not even running against extremist politicians who need to be held accountable by a good opponent. Even if they don't beat them, they should at least have someone telling every voter in that district what they're doing in that state house when no one knows it's a gift to these extremists and they just keep going and going and going.
It is shocking and what they've gotten away with. And now when you take this, all of this, in the context of, you know, the January 6th hearings and hearing what their plan was to go to the states, have their own people who are running these state legislatures put in their own electors and basically do an end run around the legitimate vote. This is how this can happen.
And by the way, next time, when I named the book Laboratories of Autocracy, it was not just to be cute off that term, Laboratories of Democracy. The laboratories part is one key piece is they're always learning from their mistakes. Like they hate the drop boxes that African-American voters use drop boxes. That was a big part of the turnout in 20. Uh-huh. So they get rid of drop boxes. They never cared about drop boxes when it was Salt Lake City and in Anchorage, where they've been for years. But black voters use them in, you know, Georgia, Detroit, and Wisconsin. They want to get rid of them. And they are getting rid of them. So they're always learning from their failures. And they correct for those failures. So you bet they're learning from the failure of January 6th, which is get to those state houses earlier. Don't do it through some riot on the Capitol. Do it through machinations in November and December with state houses. In this independent state house theory nonsense is part of that. So, yeah, they're going to try and figure out how to get that Eastman thinking back to state capitals long before, you know, the 2025 final stages of a transition. So it's very disturbing. And that puts on us. We have to be thinking ahead of what they'll do next. We have to hold Trump accountable for January 6th and Meadows and all of them. But don't be fooled. And I say this in the book. I say it all the time. The attack on democracy preceded Donald Trump ever running for president.
Mm-hmm.
If he was locked up tomorrow, it would continue. If he had admitted he lost on November 4th, they still would have banned drop boxes.
Mm-hmm.
People would still be pushing the independent state legislature theory. The attack on democracy will continue if Donald Trump were to disappear tomorrow. And we need to be prepared for that.
Exactly. And I've been warning people about DeSantis because he's here poised to take over. Donald Trump is, I think the hearings are having an effect. I think it's sinking in for some people. There are others who have blinders on who are still carrying his water, and I just don't get it. But he is an afterthought at this point. They play the long game. They always have. There's a clip, you know, that I don't think holds true anymore, but it shows how long they've been doing this. This clip is from 1980. You've heard it. It's Paul Weyrich.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And that was the case back then, because they had a smaller base. And so if more people turned out to vote, they would lose. Now they've built their base, but they've done this over 50 years. So they do play the long game. And it seems like, and I hate to say it, but the Democrats have been asleep at the wheel. They didn't see this coming.
You know, the other you played the whiteboard that has been most shared on my Twitter feed ever.
Oh, wow.
It tells a history that too many people don't know.
Right.
The other whiteboard that went viral more than the others was when I explained their long game.
Mm-hmm.
Their long game is what you just heard. So our side, the Democrats, generally believe in democracy and we believe it's intact. We kind of take it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe that our viewpoints are generally a majority held viewpoint. And that's true. You know, Roe v. Wade, common sense gun reform, dealing with climate change, middle class based economics. These are mainstream ideas. So we run around and say, well, we'll just talk about what we're for. And most people are for those things. So we're going to win.
Right.
Because we think about it that way, we also think, well, let's go win federal elections. That's very efficient. So we focus on those swing states. Mm. I talked about. Weyrich and the others on their side, they know, one, that democracy isn't that stable and can be undermined through the state houses we've talked about. And number two, they know that their view is a minority view. And they may have built a base, but most people still oppose their view on Roe v. Wade. Most people don't support crazy gun laws or trickle-down economics that the Koch brothers want. They know this. So their game is not ours, which is to win elections on a fair democracy, mm-hmm. as he describes. Theirs is to rig a democracy enough so that they can insert their minority viewpoints over time. They know that if they simply ran a repeat election on a fair playing field, they would lose because they represent views that are held by 30, maybe 40% on a best day of the population's views. They know that. So their long game is not a battle over elections like ours. It's a battle over democracy.
Right.
And that's why they've made the end run that the founders worried about, go for state houses, and of course, get courts in place. They will uphold those state houses' actions. And we still, even with the horrific decisions in the last month out of the Supreme Court, I worry that most national analysts are still forgetting the court is sort of a shield, but the sword are the state houses. And so, yes, we want to win. We want more justices. But until we go to where their sword is, which is state house after state house after state house, passing laws in their unaccountable fortresses that mm-hmm. no one can hold them accountable for, until we go there, their long game will still succeed. And I know a lot of the people involved. I'm not a lot of the current people. You know, I don't blame them. So I don't want to criticize Democrats. But over a generation, they've had a long game and run at state houses, and we just haven't.
We haven't. And until we go there. Yep.
And I watch the responses to even the Hobbs decision. And most of what I see are, we just have to elect more U.S. senators. And of course we do. But unless part of your sentence is, and we got to go back to where these laws are being passed and hold those extremists accountable by running in those places fiercely, until we start saying that, they are always on offense, and we are
always
the Senate is defense.
Always.
The state houses are offense. If we're only on defense all the time, we're still not going to win. So we have to, it's what I said, we have to all take the guarantee clause seriously, which means fight for democracy in all 50 states all the time.
So, but in practical terms, how do we do that? I'm here in Florida, where up until this past year, Democrats had a majority of the voter registrations in the state.
Right.
The Republicans have now overtaken that because the Democrats have been beaten down over decades. And look, I hate placing blame. I live in the land of woulda, coulda, shoulda. I blame myself for so many things, but I can't help but look at the 8 years of the Obama administration where we lost, I don't have the numbers, but we lost so many state houses. Yeah. We lost control at the state level. We were left in a really precarious situation when he left office, and now we see the consequences of it.
Yeah, and because we have a federal mindset, we didn't see that as a hollowing out of our democracy that we should have.
We should have.
The DNC under Tom Perez, I'll give him credit, he would talk a lot about state houses.
Funny.
So, but again, decades later than the Koch brothers were. But in a way, once you win a White House, which we have now, obviously, there's such a momentum around federal that you don't let it go down. You know what? And you ask what we can do. There's so many things that we have to do. Individual citizens can play a much bigger role in so many ways. I go through this in the book, 30 steps. You know, voter registration in some states like Florida and Ohio, Georgia, where they're purging voters all the time. Critical work. One of the biggest tools they have attacking democracy. And who are they attacking? They are attacking the Obama coalition all the time.
Right.
That's the coalition and the new generation of it that threatens them. Young people, diverse people, you know, you add up the new majority. And if it votes using drop boxes or early vote, however,
or vote by mail. Right.
The majority wins. Like Weyrich said.
Yep.
So they've been hard at work through purging and getting rid of drop boxes and now trying to pull back on early vote. Everything they can to destroy that Obama coalition, they have been doing, and they'll keep doing it. So in the states where that's especially intense, and Ohio is a poster child of where that's worked for them, the more everyone, you know, and I put this in my book, everyone has a footprint of influence in your life beyond just volunteering, beyond giving a few dollars to candidates. So I'd put it to any of your listeners, you know, are you a volunteer at a homeless shelter, at a food bank? When you go to that food bank and you volunteer, are they registering voters? If they're not, ask them why not.
Right.
Because those are the very voters that are often knocked off the rolls by the purging process.
Mm-hmm.
Check the laws of this state. The answer may be, well, we don't think we're allowed to. In some states, that may be the case. In Ohio, there's nothing stopping any nonprofit, and I believe they should be. I think it should be part of their mission to lift their constituents into our democracy. So I'd ask anyone, don't just sit around and wait for that to happen. Check it out yourself if you're involved in any way.
Right.
If you run a, you know, when Sherrod Brown was Secretary of State of Ohio, he worked with McDonald's so that on every Happy Meal tray, there was a voter registration form.
Oh, nice.
Think about the scale that would add. Or during the pandemic, Kroger's had an early vote application form after checkout.
Nice.
Why only in the pandemic? That should happen all the time.
Yeah.
So if you're involved in a small business that serves people, think about lifting all of your constituents into democracy. So that's on that very sort of civic side. If you're not as partisan, that may be the best way you can contribute. But I would say for those bigger picture, we need to start, you know, broadening our passion, not just for the 6 or 7 sexy Senate races that everybody knows about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I never fault a candidate for raising a lot of money. So I love that Val Demings is raising a lot of money. I love that Amy McGrath, good for Amy McGrath, she raised $100 million.
Yeah, well, a lot of good that did us, right?
Right, but I don't blame her. She went out and tried to raise money. But there's something wrong with our communications to grassroots supporters that we didn't say to them, hey, for every $3 you give to those sexy Senate races, give two to critical state house races in the same state.
Right.
Or in a, you know, at the same time, Amy McGrath raised $100 million. There were dozens of uncontested districts in places like Ohio and Kentucky, right around the corner, in state houses.
Right.
And so I would, you know, big picture, Joe Biden, the DNC and others need to say to the broad universe, you know, there is a powerful group of small dollar donors that explode when they get excited and support. But we don't channel enough to them what they should get excited about if their goal is to actually save democracy. And if you had some of that $100 million that Amy McGrath had split among every state house candidate in a state like Kentucky or Ohio, it would make an enormous, it would go even further than some final amount of TV ads she spent. So
that's right.
We have to start in every way. And so the reason I mentioned Amy McGrath or something is the money is there. The passion is there. So it's not like it's impossible. We just have not communicated well that, oh, you want to save democracy? Okay. It's way beyond 6 Senate seats, folks. That's trying to do it on the cheap. We got to go deeper into states and fight back in states. Because again, Ron DeSantis and your state house, that stuff they're doing isn't popular in Florida.
It's horrible. It's horrible. And the thing is, because they run the media, they control so much media,
right. They're
putting their false narrative out there. And people, Ron DeSantis, has a good approval ratings. Maybe not so much in Florida anymore, but around the country, they're buying the bullshit that says,
here's the best thing for his opponent. I know there's a primary. We need to take some of that $100 million from Amy McGrath down the road. That hypothetical money. Wouldn't it be great to have a well-funded Florida state house candidate in every district in Florida?
Yes.
Running hard against the incumbents who are voting for such extreme nonsense.
Yeah.
That would be the best thing for any of your statewide candidates. When we leave dozens of these districts uncontested, again, it's a gift and it allows that extremism to just explode. No one's even running locally to say what's happening. So we have to start fighting at all levels. There's dollars, there's passion. And by the way, we have to fight even places we know we're going to lose.
Of course.
But we have to fight because making the noise is better than a monopoly, a Fox News, basically, coverage of a whole district.
Right. And the problem is we're not doing that. And the problem,
a
big part of it, and I'm sorry, my listeners, some of them get mad when I criticize because I care and I want us to do better. Joe Biden is not winning over the people that he needs to win over to get this coalition working. The young people, he's not helping by criticizing the progressives, which he again today did in Israel. This is the second time in a week he's dissed the progressives. Well, he wouldn't be in office without the progressives, and he's going against the wrong people, and I'm afraid it's going to hurt us in the long run.
Yeah, no. When he has those moments, I don't understand it. I try to triangulate right now. And maybe that's some strategy. I agree with you. I mean, you need, especially in a midterm. Who does not show up in a midterm that really hurts us? Young people traditionally
don't
show up.
Right.
So the idea that you're going to alienate young people are the reason Obama won twice.
They
showed up in such big numbers and voted by such a margin that without them, he would have not won Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, and won a Pennsylvania. Right. Obama would have lost. But then they don't show up in a midterm because people aren't explaining why. What else is at stake? So, yeah, alienating young people 6 months before a midterm is a horrible political strategy.
Horrible.
I don't know who you're winning over by doing that. The other thing I'd say about, frankly, the Biden in the Senate, I don't believe they've really grasped, maybe more recently, the moment of threat to democracy. I wish they would watch the video that you showed at the beginning.
I do too.
Because once you understand what happened that led Jim Crow, and by the way, there's another video I did later. There was literally a bill in 1890 before the Congress that would have really put a stop to all the things I talked about. And they passed two economic bills that year and never did the third one that was called the Force Act. It would have stopped a lot of those attacks. And they let it get filibustered and they wouldn't overcome the filibuster. And that was the end. And I worry that if we don't, I think they still need to act. I still think they need to act this year. Mm-hmm. You know, Republicans in Ohio were found to have violated the Ohio Constitution 5 times and they just kept gerrymandering. We had one vote on voting rights in January, and we've never brought it up again. Who's going to win, the side that doesn't stop fighting after 5 times or the side that quits after one? They need to keep fighting because my worry is, like 1890, like that video, that in decades from now, when you and I are each 50, we'll look back and say the most important moment of that 2021-22 Congress was not anything they did, but it was what they didn't do.
Yeah.
Democracy was literally under attack and they didn't do a damn thing. And that's my fear. And Biden, Schumer, you name it, they need to, I see they're negotiating still with Manchin over Build Back Better.
Listen, yes.
I like a lot of what's in there, but democracy, there's going to be no Build Back Better if we don't have democracy in 2 years. And why they're spending all their time on that and why they've cut deals on other things without saying, you must vote for this is beyond me.
Right.
And
also
they're
fighting over the wrong things and they're letting the entire nation be held hostage by Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. The filibuster, first of all, is nowhere in the Constitution. And second of all, if you think the minute the Republicans get control of the Senate, they don't kill the filibuster to put in a national anti-abortion law, then you're not paying attention.
Here's the thing, though. If you see their long game, They don't need the filibuster as much as we do. Why?
Because they don't govern.
Most of the damage is done through state houses.
That's right, right.
90% of their agenda. What did they do when Trump was president and they had both houses? Nothing but tax cuts
right.
and judges.
Right,
and
tax cuts and judges.
They don't need a filibuster for judges.
Nope.
So they 90% of their agenda is done through state houses. And judges need a majority vote. The judges uphold those state houses' work. Mitch McConnell doesn't need the filibuster because
no.
he's getting everything he wants done without it because
right.
judges get through anyway.
That's right.
And so they're sitting pretty on their agenda. And it's one reason why McConnell could be so self-righteous about the filibuster, because for their long game, it isn't necessary. For our long game, passing a voting rights and democracy protection bill in states is by far the
crucial.
Most important thing.
Now, and we didn't do it, and it's done.
If you fail to do it, everything will continue. Even if they don't pass a national ban on abortion, it will continue and continue and continue.
Oh, God. This is the dystopian future. We're living it now. And the thing is, we're getting close.
Don't give up.
Well,
I wrote my book, so people, there are 30 steps that we all can take. It starts with Manchin and Biden, but it includes all of us, like I was saying earlier. It's not too late, but we all got a lot of work to do, obviously.
Yes, we do. Hey, David Pepper, if you've got a moment, we're running into overtime. A Progressive Voices okay. Network is leaving us, but my husband's here, and he's been listening, and he has a burning comment or question or something.
Okay.
This is David. David.
Hello, hi, David. I loved everything that you had to say, but I have a caveat.
Okay.
Why do the maggots love Trump? I'll answer the question. He promised some things, and he delivered them. Joe Biden ran on forgiving student debt. He ran on other promises as well. He ran on a clean environment.
He ran on minimum wage. He ran on
health care. And how many of those things has he delivered? None of them. Not a one. And that's a big reason why people don't get motivated to give money to these state races, why they don't get motivated to go out and knock on doors for candidates, because their attitude is, you promised me this, you didn't give it to me, why should I go out and bust my ass for you?
Because we're not as bad as the other guys?
The one thing I would disagree, I don't think Trump gave them much of what he said. I actually think if you look at what he said, he said a lot, and he did talk to, he did go to some areas that are overlooked, and he did talk to them in ways that I think they thought, man, this guy actually knows that my town is falling apart. And so I think he did go to some places, and that did help him. Did he turn those towns apart or do anything like infrastructure? No.
And no, he did
the economy in Ohio was worse than it had been in a decade, even before COVID hit. But he did go to those places, and you know, there's also a whole lot of other reasons that people voted for him, including white supremacy,
yes.
But not everyone, but there was a strand of that in his support. But I do think Joe Biden, you know, he's done some big things in a crisis. You know, the jobs picture and other things, you know, are strong. Inflation's not, et cetera. But yeah, I think that the reticence to do some big things on things like student debt, when that was clearly, it wasn't just him, that was the whole primary was all about how we had to take this on.
Right.
And not delivering on some of these big things, not fighting hard for voting rights, to say vote again so then we'll preserve voting rights, instead of early 21 fighting like it because it's on the line and the people in Georgia know it, they've been living with it. I think not fighting that fight, you know, one of the things I really think is important is people are watching what you do, and some are judging it, as David said, that you're not doing what you promised. But the other thing I really worry about when people are more passive than I think need to be is, for all those who are not sure which side is right, they see your inactivity and think, well, it must not be that bad.
Right.
I mean, you hear me and you talking about what's happening to democracy. Someone watching me maybe doesn't like me or likes me, but they would think, man, he really thinks there's a crisis because the way he talks about it. If you sit around in the U.S. Senate for all of 2021 and don't have a single vote to protect democracy, if Joe Biden doesn't even talk about it till Georgia in 22, if they don't require a standing filibuster, people block it. If it looks like business as usual, they walk away, they never call a vote again. half of America's going to think it must not be that bad. They're not fighting for it like it's bad. So why do I think it's bad? We're leaving this impression that it's business as usual time. And I think that's where I'd like to see the senators beyond cinema and mansion. I'd like to see other Democrats stay. I'm not leaving this chamber until we have a vote on this. I'm not walking out, Chuck Schumer. I want to have a standing filibuster. I want Chuck Grassley. If he wants to filibuster voting rights across this country, I want Chuck Grassley and Rob Portman, Josh Hawley asleep at their desks because we haven't let them leave this room.
Right.
I mean, I think people need to see that, to David's point, some fight. Because one, some people believe that fight's needed and that will motivate them. But two, everyone who doesn't really understand between the two sides who's right would at least see one side acting like there's a real crisis versus acting like nothing bad must be happening.
Exactly.
And I really worry that we're letting people just, I worry that people do not see the threat for what it is. And I worry that some of the reason for that is the very leaders you'd expect to be worked up about it seem too calm about it.
Perfectly said. It's so true. And then to add insult to injury, there's Joe Biden dissing the progressives. Again, the coalition that he needs to move forward. And, you know, from on abortion, oh, it's those activists that, with, you know, they're out of step with the rest of the party. Excuse me?
Yeah.
You know,
that was awful.
Horrible.
I don't understand that one. And there was another one about 6 months ago that they said, those voting rights groups, everyone has their issue. Wait,
oh my God.
Democracy is
there is no
side,
bigger like issue.
A special interest issue.
Right.
It was sort of like the dissing of the abortion, you know, activists, which are core and represent, again, the large majority of Americans.
Yes. So, David Pepper, here's the thing. Some people get it. Before you came on, there were two major threads that captivated me over the last week. One was yours that got me to get in touch and say, come back on the show. The other was from a guy who I never heard of before. Someone forwarded this thread to me. It's a guy, Joe. He's at Dempsey2, DempseyTwo. And I read this whole thing, and he talks about in a very sort of offhand and kind of humorous and snarky manner, the mess we're in and how we got here. And at the very end, it's like tweet number 25 in the thread. He said, and finally, I know not all Christians and not all Republicans. To you, I ask that you show up to vote. Don't sit this one out. This is the election to save a democracy. It's going to feel weird voting for a Democrat, but I assure you the alternative is unthinkably worse. So I read through the whole thing. I had no idea this guy was a Republican, but he gets it. He sees what they're doing. Yeah. And it's a brilliant thread. You should.
And that goes back, and that's great. I'll look him up. This goes back to one of the mistakes we make when we think it's all about Trump. Is that it's provided cover to a whole lot of Republicans who are against democracy.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say never Trump, never Trump, and when everyone says it's January 6th and it's Trump, no, it started before Trump. It will continue after Trump. And what happened in 2020 is a perfect case study. Many voters voted for Joe Biden and then Republicans the rest of the way because we told them it's about Trump. And the very Republicans they voted for are the ones who led those phony
audits
in Arizona. They're the ones banning drop boxes. We got to go deeper. It's going to say, okay, yeah, we don't want Trump and he should be held accountable.
But your state all house down the line
is attacking democracy. And you need to know that. And you need to study that. And if for the same reason you're offended by January 6th, you should be offended by a state house member who's rigged their own districts, voted for abortion bans with no exceptions, and basically getting rid of ways to vote so that they never lose. And if we don't get beyond just the Trump stuff, we ended up providing cover to a whole lot of people. And so that's what I love with that tweet said.
Oh, it was perfect. And again, you get through the entire thread and it's a lengthy, very forceful, informative thread. I spent 15 minutes reading it because I thought it was that important. But we can wrap up by, I think, something you wrote, a play on an old saying. It's the state houses, stupid.
Yeah.
Right. So change your focus. Yes, we need two more senators than we have now, because Manchinima, first of the fact that Biden and let us be derailed by these two is also it just doesn't look good. It's just a really bad look for a party who fought to get control. I mean, we controlled the Senate because of Warnock and Ossoff in Georgia. We won the election. And you have these two jerks derailing the whole agenda. Things could be wholly different if they would have just gone along with the party. But we'd still have to contend with the state houses. Yeah. And these, you know, Pennsylvania, they did an abortion bill in like the dead of night. This is not okay.
Pennsylvania is a blue state. It's just, it's one of the worst gerrymandered states. Let me just say this way. I don't want to minimize the importance of winning your Florida Senate race or our Ohio Senate race. But here's what I would say to people listening. We all believe to our core, and we're right, that trickle-down economics does not work. It doesn't help the little guy. So why do we think it works with politics? Why do we think giving all our money to Tim Ryan somehow means that that state house candidate has a chance? That's what we've been doing. We do trickle-down economics for political giving. So I'd say to people listening, help in Florida, help Val Demings win, help Tim Ryan win in Fetterman, but don't stop there. Don't assume that them winning means you're going to win that state district that you want to win too.
If one has nothing to do with the other.
Help them out, get out and knock on doors for them. Don't save it all for just a few races at the top. It does not trickle down in the way we like. They need help at that level. They need enough money to point out how extreme their opponent is. And if they win, wonderful. And if they don't win, but they've pointed that out, they've still made a difference.
Absolutely.
And so in all of us volunteering and giving need to just go beyond the Senate races. We're all told is all that matters, and get down onto the state level again, where most of the damage is being done and where the Koch brothers and Alec have basically had the show to themselves for 40 years. Yeah. We need to interrupt that finally.
Without a doubt. David Pepper, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back, because we need to hear more of this. And frankly, there are not enough people on our side saying what you're saying. And
thank you.
Yeah,
great to be with you. And nice
to
hear from you, David.
Thank you so much. We'll be in touch. Yeah. David Pepper. And he's on Twitter at David Pepper. So thank you so much. We'll talk again. Bye-bye. And with that, we're done. There goes my video thing. We ran over today, but it was important that we do. And run for office. You know, the maggots are running for every office, from school board, and they are taking over the school boards because they don't want your kids to be able to learn history. So run for office and be sure to vote and proselytize until you're sick of talking, because we say it every election. This is the most important election in our lifetimes. And if we don't get a handle on this now, we are completely screwed, and not in a good way. All right. Tomorrow, Howie's here. It's Thursday. Howie Klein will be here, and Marie Newman will join us. You need to hear this, because Marie Newman defeated the worst so-called Democrat in the House 2 years ago when she beat Dan Lipinski in a primary. Well, now the Lipinski people, and that includes Hakeem Jeffries, ousted her in a primary. Lovely. We're going to do a bit of a postmortem on that with Marie Newman tomorrow. So please be here for that. All right. Thank you for listening. I know it's late. I appreciate you hanging in. This was important territory we covered today. I will post links to both the threads, the one from Joe at Dempsey2 and from David Pepper, the one that he basically did for you instead of me reading the thread, but it's something you can share because it's so important. These are messages that must go viral. Otherwise, we're going to get viraled out of existence. All right. I'll leave you with the news. I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you for listening, everybody. Thanks for your support. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The House Select Committee investigating the events surrounding the attack on the Capitol last January 6th held its seventh public hearing on Tuesday. This one focusing on the role of extremist groups and the degree to which the then president and his allies helped coordinate those events in advance. Former White House counsel Pat Cipollone sat for a taped deposition on Friday. The video was turned around quickly so that portions could be shown on Tuesday. During one of those taped segments, Cipollone said that he urged Trump to concede the election, that he criticized plans to seize voting machines, and to have the former Vice President Mike Pence refuse to certify the results. We also learned of a very intense Oval Office meeting on December 18th that should never have happened and seemed to have prompted Donald Trump's tweet urging people to show up on January 6th and that it would be wild. The committee also revealed an unsent draft tweet written before January 6th in which Trump would have encouraged supporters to march from his morning speech to the Capitol, a statement that the panel said showed that the day's events were not spontaneous. And at the end of the hearing, co-chair Liz Cheney shared another bombshell.
After our last hearing, President Trump tried to call a witness in our investigation, a witness you have not yet seen in these hearings. That person declined to answer or respond to President Trump's call and instead alerted their lawyer to the call. Their lawyer alerted us. And this committee has supplied that information to the Department of Justice. Let me say one more time, we will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously.
Witness tampering is serious stuff. The final planned hearing, originally scheduled for this Thursday, was delayed due to new testimony from Cipollone and former Trump advisor Steve Bannon's agreement to testify, though who knows. So that eighth hearing will instead happen next Thursday evening in prime time, beginning at 8 p.m. Eastern. Well, expected but still bad news from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In June, inflation soared 9.1% higher than last year. Analysts saying much of it due to high gas prices, along with increased costs for housing, food, and energy. And yes, that's bad. But know that the inflation problem is a global concern. The euro is now equal in value to the U.S. dollar for the first time in 20 years. The two currencies hit parity on Tuesday amid recession concerns fueled by continuing inflation and persistently high energy prices there and here. So the euro, which is shared by 19 member countries, has lost more than 10% of its value since the start of the year. It was last worth less than the U.S. dollar back in 2002 when the currency was still brand new. And just FYI, annual inflation in the eurozone reached a record 8.6% in June, and the European Central Bank is preparing for its first rate hike in 11 years next week. So we are not alone. Say it ain't so, Joe. After the extreme court overturned Roe v. Wade and a woman's right to choose what happens with her own body, we learned that the Biden administration had planned that same day to nominate an anti-abortion attorney named Chad Meredith to a lifetime appointment on the federal bench. It appears to be part of a deal that President Biden struck with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. So the nomination had been scheduled to be announced on June 24th, the day the court announced the decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization and overturned Roe v. Wade. So the nomination was scuttled after the ruling. Some of us thought that the president realized what a mistake that would be, but now we hear it was only a delay and the nomination will move forward. Oh, I get it, because when Republicans are in power, they nominate pro-choice judges and make other moves to cooperate with the Democrats. Oh, wait. Never mind.
Come on, man.
Meanwhile, President Biden landed in Israel Wednesday morning, his first stop on a four-day trip to the Middle East, his first to the region as president. Biden will meet with 11 regional leaders and attempt to restore the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. He'll attempt to bring Israel and Saudi Arabia closer together and speed up the flow of oil to the U.S. as Russia's invasion of Ukraine disrupts supply. And he will also hold a very controversial meeting with Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. This comes less than 2 years after Biden vowed to make the nation a pariah and following the 2018 murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The CIA believes the Crown Prince is behind the killing of Khashoggi, who lived in the U.S. and wrote for The Washington Post.
Come on, man.
Now, I'd say COVID's back, But it never went away, despite many Americans acting as if it was no longer a threat. Well, au contraire, mon frère, the Biden administration on Tuesday urging Americans to take advantage of all that's available. Booster shots, testing kits, and treatments to combat this highly contagious and now dominant Omicron subvariant BA5. BA5 now accounts for 65% of U.S. COVID cases, and hospitalizations, again, are on the rise. Wear a mask. And finally, surveillance footage from the Uvalde, Texas mass shooting at Robb Elementary School was leaked to the public on Tuesday following a legal wrangling between local and state officials over the release of the footage. The nearly 90-minute long video captures the moments the gunman entered the building, as well as a hallway view of the police response outside of a barricaded classroom. It's very difficult to watch, especially when you see the police just hanging out, one of them getting some hand sanitizer. 19 students and 2 teachers were killed during the attack. Local officials have faced intense scrutiny for waiting 75 minutes to enter the classroom to engage the shooter and for providing contradictory details in the aftermath of the attack. Reports suggest commanding officers were told not to engage, despite multiple calls from the students inside the classroom to 911 begging for help. State and federal probes into the police response are, as they say, ongoing. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.